Welcome to the To Read List. I'm Bailey, and this is a podcast where I attempt to get through the 126 unread books on my shelf. With me, as always, is my friend Toby.
Hey.
My brother Andrew.
Hello.
And my husband Dylan's the sound recordist.
Hello.
I feel like we talked to you recently, so it's good to talk to you again. Happy International Women's Day.
Happy International Women's Day. Happy birthday, Andrew, again.
Well, for our pejos, because of some scheduling conflicts with upcoming travel, we're recording this one sort of right on the heels of our last visit to your ears. So we might not have as much to talk about in this intro. Hopefully no one has shame between last time we recorded and now.
Yeah, Bailey. No, I do not.
Oh, I do have shame.
Oh.
Oh, Toby, you're the little turd.
I'm the little turd this time. I have to look up an author.
I did get from the little free library down the street a free copy of Tacky the Penguin for Maggie, so I'm not
ashamed. Sounds like shame.
No.
How did you not already have that one?
As I've been covered repeatedly, children's books do not count as shame. Otherwise, we would be here all day.
Yeah, I'm thick with shame. I'm covered in a shame custard.
Oh, God.
Yuck.
I was looking for a book to buy my dad for his birthday coming up, and I didn't find one for him, but I did find two books for me. One of them was a book that threw me right back into childhood. It's actually a collection called Five Novels by Daniel Pinkwater. Daniel Pinkwater is a super bizarre children's author. He's kind of like an American Roald Dahl, but I would say even weirder. He has books that are titled things like Alan Mendelsohn, Boy from Mars, The Snark Out Boys, and The Avocado of Death, stuff like that. And I remember picking this up when I was a teenager and loving it. It has a very distinctive cover of the author himself with his hand outstretched to show all five of his fingers, one for each novel.
Oh, wow.
Those books sound like titles that they would make up in some movie, I'm going to go talk about The Avocado of Destiny or whatever.
I was so excited to see it that I did buy it. It was a used bookstore, so I was like, this is cheap. And then I'm the one who's screwing everyone's schedule up. I'm going on a trip, and I know I'm going to finish whatever book I have in my hands now on the trip, and I don't want to buy an airport paperback for $38. So instead, I picked up a copy of Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. And I hope I'm pronouncing that author's name right. Award-winning sci-fi book came out a couple years ago, took all the sci-fi awards by storm. As I understand it, it's about a ship that has a human mind trapped in it or something, or maybe the reverse. I can't remember. But anyway, it's supposed to be really good.
A human mind that has a ship trapped in it?
Yeah, I was going to say, you mean a human that thinks he's a ship?
I did not like this book.
Oh.
But it's also very much not my jam. Style-wise,
okay.
What I remember most about the book, besides it involving ships and things, was that none of the characters are gendered, but they have genders. They just don't have gendered pronouns. So it was very confusing to figure out who was who. But I'm curious to know, if your experience is different.
I'm excited to read it. Do you remember which way it is? Is it a human who thinks it's a ship, or is it a ship that thinks it's a human?
I wish I could tell you. All I remember is being confused about it. I think it's a person. But that's so funny, Toby, because I have written down for my first point of conversation, Toby's trip, ask him how many books he's going to take. It's just Ancillary Justice. Are you taking anything else on your... How long is your trip?
I'm going to be gone. I'm going to England to see Louise's family. We're going to take a little side trip for ourselves to old Istanbul, where Andrew has so recently graced. And I'm only taking, I guess it counts as two books. I'm reading one on my devices from the library. I'm rereading Gone Girl on a whim and loving it. Man, it's so good. And then I'm going to take Ancillary Justice.
Here's the thing, Toby. I remember you not liking Gone Girl. So I guess the perspective's changed.
I think Gone Girl was one of the first audiobooks that I read as an adult. And I think it is a very long audiobook. It's a very long book for what it is, for a thriller. It's I'd say 30 or 40% longer than your normal thriller.
I remember you saying that you hated it, and that if you ever met the author, that you would attack her violently. And I remember writing that down in my diary.
Uh-huh. Well, it's certainly not true. I've ended up reading all of her books, so...
It was written in his diary, so it's got to be real.
In Dylan's diary about you.
Yeah, okay. And, well, you do have a diary for each of your friends, and that's true.
So. Toby, in Istanbul, I don't know if you like creamy drinks made out of orchid root, but you should try salep.
Mm. That sounds mysterious, but good.
It's a hot, creamy drink made out of orchid root.
I see. Yum. I know so much about the first half of that description. And the last half, I don't know. I don't know what that is.
It's good. It's available at a lot of the like street food stalls. Hit me up if you have any other questions.
Sweet. I'll hit you post-pod.
Andrew, did you always get extras when you ordered it?
No, I want to say this to everybody listening. Mm-hmm. If you go to Istanbul and you are within the normal hours and you try to go to the Blue Mosque, if people stop and tell you the mosque is closed, they are trying to trick you to have you do another form of business. It's open. Just go. It happened to me, and he wanted me to go to a bazaar with him. I didn't go with him. Last thing I'll tell you, Toby, there are lots of cats. Get excited for that.
Oh, yeah.
Kitty. Oh, yeah. I'm already hyped. You know it.
Have you seen the documentary Kitty, spelled K-E-D-I, on YouTube?
No.
It's about the cats of Istanbul. Oh, yeah. You should get hype. The other thing I have written down here to talk about in the intro, Andrew, tell us about the shirt I bought you.
Wow.
It is one of these shirts that's sort of like a shirt of the moment that looks like sort of an old band or sports tee from like the 80s or 90s that has like a big name and pictures on it. Like I've seen ones for like Mr. Darcy. I actually gave Jillian a Mr. Darcy one. I've seen ones for like Olivia Benson. They have them for everybody. Elaine from Seinfeld. Anywho, the best one arrived in my mailbox.
Thank
and
you.
And it is a picture of Tom Hollander's Mr. Collins from the 2005 Pride and Prejudice. And it doesn't say Mr. Collins on it because we're not celebrating him. But what we are celebrating is the phrase, "What excellent boiled potatoes." And so it's just a big shirt that has pictures of Tom Hollander on it. It says, "What excellent boiled potatoes." Picture of him serving himself up and a picture of him in his jaunty cap. It's I don't say a masterpiece lightly, but it is it is that.
Please let me know if you get any good people on the street like giving you like a thumbs up.
I will.
I get a lot of people talking to me about my Greek myth shirts.
Oh no.
That's what you get. Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of people pushing me into the street in front of cars.
Hmm. Yeah. And telling you that the Blue Mosque is
closed. But maybe with my new shirt it won't happen.
Speaking of new shirts, wait, I forgot what Toby's book.
You liar.
Oh.
I love new shirts. I'm in a club about them. Just kidding. Toby, did you read a book this week?
Wow.
Wow. All right. So, Pedro's, we promise there'll be an extra long break between this episode and next one. We'll come back swinging. Yes, I did read a book for this episode. I read The Liar's Club by Mary Carr.
Liar?
Vroom, vroom.
Vroom, vroom.
Because a car is like an automobile.
Oh,
it's the thing people try to push me in front of on the street.
Something about liars. all right, here's your sort of log line. The Liar's Club, Mary Carr's memoir of her tumultuous childhood as the daughter of two fascinating and very complicated parents in Southeast Texas, is, by turns, funny, elegant, crude, life-affirming, and as dark as any book you'll ever read.
Ooh. Ooh. Uh-huh. I feel like that's a challenge. Uh-huh. Okay.
This is one of those books I didn't really realize was famous. At the time it came out, and probably for the next decade or so, it was very famous, and people kind of give it credit for reinvigorating the memoir genre, which is a bold claim. But I can see how this book would do that. So yeah, I think in its day, it was huge. I think it has been eclipsed, and this is like a little bit of commentary from me, by other memoirs that are a little bit more digestible, that are a little bit less intense. I'm thinking of stuff like Half Broke Horses by Jeanette Wells, which is, I think, a great book, but I would say pales in comparison to this one. But this one is a much tougher pill to swallow. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, can you stop getting ahead of yourself, Toby?
Sorry. I'm just gushing. This is, as I've said, a memoir of Mary Carr's childhood. She grew up for a lot of it in a very small town in Southeast Texas called Leechfield. Leechfield sounds like a place that I never want to go. It is ultra industrial, or at least it was when she was growing up there. There are multiple oil refineries and chemical plants. You can kind of see them all over the horizon. It's like a swampy, semi-tropical climate with mosquitoes and heat waves and a pretty nasty place to live. But she kind of tells the tale of herself and her sister growing up there, and they don't know any different. They're just kind of living their childhood lives there. And as well, they are kind of living in a situation that they don't know is different, at least at the beginning of their lives. And that situation is living with two parents who are dealing with pretty severe alcoholism. That is actually the title of the book, The Liar's Club, refers to father's drinking buddies. They get together a couple times a week when they're not working at the plant, and they tell stories, or more specifically, Carr's father tells stories, kind of these semi-tall tales that she recreates on the page and are often funny and have little twists to them. They're, you know, a repeated motif throughout the book, and they're really, really well done. But that is The Liar's Club of the title.
I should also point out that a leech field is something to do with a septic tank, so I don't know why any town would name themselves that.
That's a good question. Mary has an older sister, Lisa, which is spelled L-E-C-I-A, which shocked me because I read this audiobook, and then I was like, who's Lekia? And I was like, oh, okay, it's Lisa. And although Lisa exists, only Mary is invited along to accompany her father to the meetings of the Liars Club. And she thinks it's a big deal. She gets to sit there and listen to his stories, and she loves doing it. The stories often give kind of lighter counterpoints to the at times black hole heaviness of the events of Mary's young life. Throughout the book, Mary's parents fall in and out of love. They struggle with their own compulsions and generally prove to be one of the most fully realized and incredibly painted pair of characters I've ever read about in my entire reading life. Stuff gets ultra, ultra dark, but there is never a moment where the love and affection that the family feels for each other is not also rendered. And it is as complicated as it sounds.
It's not sounding very fun to me, yeah, but that could be my own stuff.
I wouldn't classify it as fun. Certainly, there are parts of it that are fun and I'll get into it. So I'll start with my orcs. Are you ready?
Yes.
Uh-oh.
Here we go. Sometimes the book can feel a little bit slow. End of orcs.
Uh-oh.
I could tell. I could freaking tell.
So many elves that I am limiting myself to the amount of elves that I'm going to talk about here. This book had me crying into my guacamole. I was finishing this book, and at a point I was making guacamole for something I was doing later that night, and I was crying, like tears running down my face. I had to stop making my guacamole and sit down.
Well, no salt needed.
No salt needed. This book is incredible. It hits you like a sledgehammer. I can't really tell you what that thing is that made me react that way. I think if you've read the book, you probably know that there's a revelation toward the end that can hit very hard. But that is how powerful this book is. More specifically, she is an incredible writer, and she's really mastered the trick of the correct image at the correct time. Her metaphors just sound so true. It sounds like nobody even wrote them. They just sound like true things in the universe. I don't know. Her ability to conjure this imagery to say exactly the right thing is unbelievable.
Her metaphors are like words that are written on a really nice piece of paper.
That's a simile.
No!
She's also really, really funny. There's several parts of the book where I kept thinking of David Sedaris, who is another quote-unquote memoirist. He's admitted that he kind of takes real life events in his life and maybe embellishes them. And while Sedaris can kind of embellish things and make them larger than life for humor, I would say Mary Carr is more wry and well-observed and kind of just cutting. I love them both, but it's a different flavor of humor, but it's also somehow related. And I mean that as a big compliment.
I just want to say, like, it occurs to me in this moment that Sedaris probably has to make some stuff up, because at this point he's written, like, how many memoirs? He's running out of things to write about.
Mm-hmm. Carr also has an ability to move her narrative back and forth between lighthearted and nostalgic topics to literally the darkest things you can imagine. There are events in this book that I will not even mention what they are on this podcast. I will say beyond strongly, you must Google your trigger warnings before you read this book. And those sections are written in ways that are so powerful that I found myself physically sick reading parts of this book. And then finally, Carr perfectly captures the feeling of being a child. She kind of hypnotizes you with it. You're thrust back to a time in your life when you are completely dependent upon and also kind of obsessed with your parents. You think about them, you know, they're basically most of your world is these giant people who are, they're telling you what to do. They're kind kind of circumscribing your life, and there are many, many aspects to them that are completely unknowable to you. And she kind of paints that picture so vividly in quote-unquote normal scenarios that when the narrative moves into these more extreme scenarios, things with the kind of darker sides of her parents, you're kind of taken along with her. You're in that spell. And it's just incredibly well done. So I really like this book. I can't recommend it enough. Like I said, I wouldn't necessarily describe it as fun, but it is absolutely amazing. 5 stars. I'm delighted that I read it, and I want to read more of her work.
I'm really glad you liked it. I don't think I will ever read this book.
Fair.
But I trust you. If you told me, like, no, it's worth it, maybe I would. But that's great. I'm so glad you liked it. Sometimes you just need a book that gives you a good cry into a guacamole. Mm-hmm. You know?
Everyone needs a good guacamole.
Just be careful when you're rubbing your eyes if you're using jalapeno in it.
I literally ran into that problem. I was like, oh, yeah. I got to go to the bathroom and wash my hands.
Awesome. Andrew, do you have any facts on Miss Mary Carr?
I do.
Hooray.
I didn't sleep on the job.
He's got some facts, Carr.
He's got some facts, Carr.
Come on, you show us the Carfax.
The Carfax are such. Mary Carr was born on January 16th, 1955 in Groves, Texas. And she lived in that area of Southeast Texas until she was 17 and moved to Los Angeles. Her childhood was not great.
What?
As Toby has sort of referenced, not only were her parents deeply dependent on substances, Carr herself struggled with substance abuse and later got sober, which she writes about in some of her later memoirs. Carr initially attended McAllister College in Minnesota before she paused her studies to join the anti-apartheid movement. And then eventually she completed her studies at Goddard College and completed a master's in fine arts. But the major thing that she is like, considers herself as a poet, and she's written many, many books of poetry, and she first came to prominence for her poetry. She won a Whiting Award in 1989, and her books of poetry include Abacus in 1987, The Devil's Tour in 1993, Sinner's Welcome in 2006, and Tropic of Squalor in 2018.
Man, this woman knows how to pick a title. Those are all amazing titles.
And according to her own website, however, her, like, big breakthrough came for an essay she wrote that was published in something called Parnassus called Against Decoration, which argued for content-forward poetry over showy, what she called foggy or like overly ornate style. And particularly she was like, sort of like, people are using too many metaphors. So I think that what you've picked up on, Toby, is like a very intentional, like I'm doing it the way I feel like it should be done.
Yeah.
So it was like a sort of a controversial, but also like got a lot of buzz essay, and it was well thought of enough to win a Pushcart Prize as well.
She found that she was drowning in a swimming pool of metaphors that the tarp had been pulled over.
Nope. Dylan, damn it.
Nope.
I still don't think you're
Dylan,
so
do you
close.
Know what a metaphor is? That's some good imagery there, but...
Her 1995 memoir, The Liars Club, was a bestseller for over a year, winning Best Book of the Year accolades for the New York Times, The New Yorker, and Time. And as Toby references, it's credited with like starting this renewed interest and renewed sort of like respect for the form of a memoir. And she has gone on to publish 2 more memoirs, Cherry, which I think deals with a little bit later in her like early life, and then Lit, which came out most recently, but still in the early mid 2000s. And she also has written a book called The Art of Metaphor. You know, I'm sorry.
Dylan.
Not metaphor.
No, I'm just
sorry, I misspoke.
Oh, darn.
She's also published a book titled The Art of Memoir, I guess, dedicated to continuing the craft of memoir even further.
Nice.
She was married to fellow poet Michael Milburn for 13 years, and then after their divorce dated David Foster Wallace.
Wait,
more on that just a little bit later. She has a son and converted to Catholicism later in life, an experience that she documented in her latest memoir, Lit. She describes herself as a cafeteria Catholic, meaning taking a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
She just really likes to eat the wafers.
Yeah. So she is a Catholic, but she's pro-choice, supports the ordination of women, and has some things that I think most people would think of as more liberal attitudes towards maybe social issues.
I feel like we've had a couple authors on here who've done that, you know, frankly, to me, bizarre conversion later in life, and specifically to Catholicism, too.
Yeah, like Flannery O'Connor, right?
Yeah, and I think maybe Evelyn Waugh was also into Catholicism. People who love words love Catholicism, I suppose.
The wafers are really good.
So the rest of this comes from two separate interviews that Carr did with NPR. One with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, where she's referring to her love of memoir, but also not really knowing, like thinking of different ways to teach it. Carr says, "You know, I've been thinking about the genre for a long time. And in some odd way, even though it has this huge readership, I felt a lingering obligation to defend it. You know, it's such a low rent form compared to, the, say, the novel. I mean, there's no danger of me being invited to the American Academy, you know? It's just trashy, it's primitive, it's outsider art, sort of. So in some strange way, I have loved the form so long and so hard, and I've taught about it for 30 years, I felt some, I don't know, sense of cultural jury duty or something to defend it. And I've read a lot of sort of light, L-I-T-E, how to write a memoir books that I found offered all these great exercises or what writing teachers call prompts. And I was always terrible at those. When I was given a prompt, I always just wrote, I'm very sad, Mary Carr."
Oh, no.
Which doesn't directly relate to what we're talking about, but I thought that last quote was funny, so I included it. Her interview, like, reads very funny. I think that, like, that personality that you caught in her writing comes through. The, like, Terry Gross interview transcript was hard to pull things for the facts, but was very entertaining to read. And then I referenced that she dated David Foster Wallace. She was the first person who really came out and brought to light the accusations around Foster Wallace's abuse and violence in their relationship. So you'll often see her associated with him. I included a quote, not because I wanted this to be about her more than him, but it was all over all the things I read, so I feel like I have to say something. And so this is a quote from her interview at NPR. She says, "Believe me, I was still really devastated as anybody who ever cared for him about his suicide. Anyone who had ever talked him out of killing himself felt like a failure, obviously, and we were devastated by that death. So David was very kindly treated. If I'd wanted to burn David's house down, I could have done that and chose not to. And I didn't really go into what it was like in great detail to date him, except that it was tumultuous and very short-lived. He was violent. He became violent when he was angry. I'm not the only woman he was violent with. It's common knowledge among women who dated him that he was violent. So we knew each other a long time. We were friends a long time. We got sober with a lot of the same people, but the amount of time we dated was very short." So just throwing that out there. And to end on a more positive note, she is a longstanding professor at Syracuse, where she's known for some, like, very highly sought after classes on writing memoir. She delivered the commencement address for the university in 2015. And she also writes songs and worked on an album called Kin with Nora Jones, Lucinda Williams, and Rodney Crowell.
Wow.
Yeah. I love those totally unexpected collabs. Like, yeah, you know, Mary Carr and Nora Jones are dropping this weekend. You're like, what?
I was just thinking, Syracuse has George Saunders and Mary Carr. Well, I think George Saunders left, but cool.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, they do. And if you read that interview with Terry Gross, she goes into this writing exercise that she brings George Saunders into. It didn't make sense to include as a quote for this, but it's very funny. She basically just keeps calling him very sweet and, like, saying that she, like, kind of makes fun of him a lot in class.
Aww.
Wow. Aww. What a stacked staff, man.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for those awesome facts. Yeah. And
Andrew, thank you for that really filling facts. Meal of facts that we just had.
Sort of.
No.
Sort of.
Sort of. Really.
You would say sort the of. Facts are a filling meal.
The facts
yeah,
are.
Yeah. There we go.
Okay.
I think that one's anyway. Closer.
Anyway, that's The Liars Club by Mary Carr. 5 stars. I just feel like it's important that you know that a metaphor is a comparison between two unlike things. Okay.
I really hope the game isn't make metaphors.
Okay. And a simile is that, but using like her ass. Okay. All right. We're good? Okay.
So, Bailey, yeah. That seemed pretty rough, but I think we survived. Did you read a book this week?
Ooh, I did. I read Survivor by Chuck Palahniuk.
Chuck it up.
I'm a survivor.
I'm a Chuck Palahniuk. Yeah. So. Firstly, I know that Toby's read this. I know that Dylan's read this. Andrew, have you read it or had read any Palahniuk before?
I have not. I am unversed.
I will also say that I think I read it right around when it came out, like many years ago now. So I can't, I think I remember how it begins, but beyond that, don't quote me.
In some ways, that's good, I think, based on my review.
Well, I checked Paul and not.
The book did come out in like 1999, which is significant because I don't think it could have been published post 9/11 based on what it's about. So my relationship with Chuck Palahniuk is as follows. This is the first book I've ever read of his. Obviously, I had...
Oh, wow.
I know. But it's like one of those... Like if you were taking an exam and there was a question on Chuck Palahniuk, I feel like I could answer a question on him. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like,
wow.
I have an idea of what kinds of books he writes, his style, his tone. And I've seen Fight Club, so I'm good, right?
Billy, we're supposed to tell people about that.
That's literally the first frickin' rule.
My other association is, and I'm gonna share this. I don't think it's a secret. I think it's public knowledge that, it's accessible. Anyway, when I was a teacher, one of my coworkers who taught sophomores was sent to the rubber room. I don't know if you guys know what the rubber room is. I'll explain in a second. But for teaching a Chuck Palahniuk story.
It sounds like a Chuck Palahniuk story, actually.
I don't know what it is, but it sounds terrible.
I don't know.
I don't like this.
The rubber room might be specific to New York City. I'm not sure, but it's for teachers where they have like an equivalent of tenure and they can't fire them. So they send them there and they just have to sit there every day until eventually maybe they get a new job or something, but they still have to pay them and they come and they sit. So this guy, by the time I met him, had escaped the rubber room and was teaching and was one of the favorite teachers. But that story came up and I was like, well, what is the story? Chuck Palahniuk.
He didn't teach Guts.
Guts. Yep. He taught the story Guts.
Word.
To sophomores.
Well, okay, before you get too far into that, that will come up in the facts a bit.
Okay. So.
Yeah, well, I don't think we can describe what that story is about on this podcast.
So we'll get to that. But basically, my associations with Chuck Palahniuk were like, I was about to say naughty. That's the wrong word. But like sort of illicit and like, don't go near that. But then in reading it, it's kind of just like, you shouldn't have taught that story. That was just like not the right choice.
There's very few times when you're on the side of this, the evil school board. It's like, no, actually, you're right. They should fire that teacher.
Genuine question. Can I get sent to the rubber room just for a couple years and like bring books and stuff?
I know. I there was a time I was like, doesn't seem so bad. It's kind of like waiting for jury duty, you know.
Yeah, but it smells like erasers in there. It's terrible.
Anyway, and he was a good teacher, but what a choice. Okay, so Survivor's the first book I've read by Chuck Palahniuk, and I just want to say from the bat, I was pleasantly surprised. I really liked it. Like, I should have known that I was going to like it based on everybody loves him, but I guess I thought it would be like sort of a muscular, hypermasculine, gross book, and it's not that. So the premise is... We start on page 289, chapter 47. So you're going backwards and you end on page one. And I don't know if that would be clear in the audiobook. Anyway, you end on page one and you're starting. You are in the cockpit of a plane that is going down over the Australian outback. And the narrator, our survivor, is explaining that he has hijacked this plane. He has gotten everybody off the plane. And they're safe, but he is planning on sending the plane into the ground. So you can see why this would not work post 9/11. And he is using this time as the plane runs out of gas, and each engine, you know, he knows four engines have to fail for it to fall. He decides to record his life story on the black box of the plane. As you're going, you're learning more and more about this person and why he's doing what he's doing.
Pretty good concept, eh?
It's a really good concept. And I was interested in that concept, but then I was just drawn in even more and more and more by the details that are revealed. So I kind of don't want to go into too many of the details because for me, the power of the book was that it was propulsive. Like the end of each chapter would introduce something bizarre or mysterious, and I would want to know more about that. Like, I just thought this was like just this bad guy that, like, terrorist basically. And as it's going, not to say he's a good guy or not, he's had an interesting life with lots of different weird subcultures of the United States. It touches on celebrity, religion, cults, how to clean really well.
Yeah, Bailey, weren't you glad that you read this while you were cleaning?
Apparently, this is not a spoiler. For part of it, the narrator works cleaning houses and this sort of thing. And he is an expert on getting out like all kinds of stains or polishing certain materials. So he'll say like, do you want to know how to clean a microwave? I'll tell you. You boil a glass of water for a few minutes and then it will loosen the crud and you can clean it really easily. And I'm thinking, I'm like, are these legit tips? And apparently they are. So there's got to be a reference manual somewhere using all of the tips he has.
I always remember this book whenever somebody makes the, you're probably wondering how I got here meme.
Yeah, it's kind
of
like that.
Of like the opening. I always just remember this having the best like framing device of like, he has to think of his entire life before he goes on this stage where it's like, nah, this is the one that tops them all.
Yeah. And it's just interesting because he just starts in this deplorable place and then it just evolves and evolves to the point where you are sympathetic, but also he's deplorable. And you just end in a completely different place than where you begin, which is so strange because from the opening, you know what's going to happen. Like, it's inevitable what the ending's going to be. But you just, I don't know, you're taken to a weird spot.
Making me want to reread this.
It was really good. I read it really fast. I think, okay, I'm going between 4 and 5 stars. And I think...
Whoa.
I know. I think probably it's a 4-star book because my only orc was that there was something about the ending that wasn't satisfying. It becomes like a very heightened satire. It kind of sounds like Infinite Jest in some bits.
Yeah.
That's like weird stuff happening. I don't want to spoil it.
And there's not like magic per se, but there's weird, indescribable stuff.
It's a heightened world. So before I get into the rating, I'll give you a quote. All I'm going to say is that our character has met a person who has developed, as he says, the cure for like any disease. And that's where we start. We're a total concept marketing / public relations organization, he said. Our job is to create the concept, you patent a drug, you copyright the name. As soon as someone else develops the product, they come to us, sometimes by choice, sometimes not. I ask him, why sometimes not? The way this works is we copyright every conceivable combination of words, Greek words, Latin, English, what have you. We get the legal rights to every conceivable word a pharmaceutical company might use to name a new product. For diabetes alone, we have an inventory of 140 names, he says. He hands me stapled together pages from out of his briefcase in his lap. Glucocure, I read. Insulin Ease. Pancreate. Hemazine. Glucodan. Grodinase. I look to the next page and bottles slip out of my lap and roll along the car with the pills inside rattling. If the drug company that ever cures diabetes wants to use any combination of words, even vaguely related to the condition, they'll have to lease the right from us. So you get the idea. Like, it isn't real life. It's not outside real life, but it is satirizing. And it's clever. So although the ending, something about it lost me, and it could be that I was trying to read it quickly to finish for the podcast, I'm going to go with 5 stars. I'm going to give Chuck Palahniuk another shot, although I hear that many people say this is his best book besides Fight Club. I don't know.
If you like this one, I think Lullaby is his best one.
That's what I'm hearing.
That's what you're hearing from me 30 minutes ago when we were driving around. I said like, oh, you should read a Lullaby or like that.
I literally asked, I was like, Dylan, what else should I read by him?
Yeah, there's like this, Lullaby, Invisible Monsters, even Fight Club's good.
Well, I mean, I'm going to give Lullaby a shot. And my eyes are open to this Chuck Palahniuk guy. He's not just the naughty guts
How
man.
How timely.
Oh, no. Bailey's going to become like a 90 Sigma male Chuck Palahniuk reader now.
Oh, man.
She's going to just start listening to Joe Rogan. And
oh, gosh. So that is Survivor by Chuck Palahniuk, 5 stars. But Andrew, do you have any facts on our favorite author?
Yeah, who is this? Who is this up-and-coming author that Bailey's discovered?
Well, Chuck Palahniuk, I got facts for hopefully only a few minutes, not days.
I am Jack's facts about his life.
Charles Michael Chuck Palahniuk was born on February 21st, 1962 in Pasco, Washington. His paternal grandfather immigrated from Ukraine, and his parents were Carol Adele and Fred Palahniuk. He grew up in a mobile home in Burbank, Washington, though he regularly lived with his maternal grandparents on their cattle ranch after his parents' divorce. Palahniuk has 3 siblings, and he's a distant relation to Jack Palance. He's apparently some sort of distant nephew of the actor. So there you go. That's all my facts. Just kidding.
Whoa.
He attended the University of Oregon, graduating with a journalism degree, and then began a series of odd jobs, including reporter, diesel mechanic for Freightliner trucks, manual writer, like George Saunders, double connection. He also spent time volunteering to work at homeless shelters and for a hospice. he didn't start writing fiction until his early 30s, which I thought was interesting. And it was an interest that was sort of sparked by attending writing workshops, which he apparently started doing to meet new friends. The rare that. Person who does something like that and then becomes world famous for it.
If you read his autobiography, which is actually really good because it teaches about writing too, he talks about it, and his writing workshops sound like they're out of Fight Club. Like they're in this derelict house that they would just pay this random dude $20 to run.
But are they allowed to talk about the writing group?
Well, they're allowed to write about it.
He completed his first novel, Invisible Monsters, but it was not picked up by any publishers. He was undaunted and wrote a short story called Fight Club. Heard of it? Which he then expanded into a novel, and expanded is the sort of the wrong word. The short story is the sixth chapter of the book Fight Club. So he wrote before and after it. It was well received, but didn't sell well, which actually I didn't realize was much like the movie. The movie came out in 1999, directed by the Finch himself, David Fincher, the Gold Finch.
That's what they call him at the box office, baby.
That's right. Except it like debuted number one on its weekend, but then faded really quickly. But it had this huge groundswell of like cult popularity, which lifted the movie to the point where I don't even know if you can call it a cult classic anymore because it's so ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But that's like how it started. And then that, you know, subsequently lifted the sales of the book. But it took a while. After Fight Club, he continued to write and publish at great pace with Survivor, the book we read for this episode, and an edited version of his first novel, which didn't get published, Invisible Monsters, both coming out in 1999. That was followed by Choke in 2001, Lullaby in 2002, and Diary in 2003. To date, he has published 19 novels, some nonfiction books, and many pieces of short fiction. His most recent novel is titled Not Forever, But For Now, and it came out last year. Now we're going to get a little dark for a second. But his novel Lullaby was inspired by personal tragedy, which stemmed from his father's murder. His father, Fred, met and started a relationship with a woman named Donna Fontaine, who had a violent ex who had been in prison. And the man, Dale Shackelford, after being released from prison, followed the couple home, shot and killed them, and then lit their home on fire.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, not great. Shackelford was convicted of the murders and sentenced to death, and Palahniuk was involved in the decision to pursue the death penalty, and Lullaby apparently came out of the conflicting feelings he had about that and wanting to cope with his decision.
I did not know that.
Well, then it's not super clear in the text, so maybe that wasn't a spoiler. So he has a habit, to go a little lighter here, well, sort of lighter, lightheaded maybe. He has a habit at readings of asking listeners to hold their breath while he reads his short story Guts. It's about a subject matter we're not going to touch on this podcast that we strive to not get the explicit tag on iTunes.
Google it.
This is a tough episode for that non-explicit tag. I'll say that.
But people often pass out holding their breath during the story. The highest number I saw recorded was 67 at a single reading. Don't know why he likes doing this, but it was part of the facts I found.
Well, that teacher I know didn't do that, so, I mean.
That's fair. That would be more problematic. Survivor, as Bailey hinted at, was slated to be adapted and like become the next movie that came out, but it was shelved due to the 9/11 attacks, understandably. It wasn't going to be something that people would respond well to. He's a member of something called the Cacophony Society, which is sort of a rebellious culture jamming organization. They do a number of things, but the thing that got called out in the article I was reading was they host a yearly Santa Rampage in Portland, Oregon, which I guess is kind of like a more violent SantaCon. I don't know. They seem to have some nicer things they do as well. Or other more like highbrow, maybe not nicer, highbrow things they do.
If you read about him, Chuck Palahniuk just becomes the most Portland man that ever existed.
Yeah.
Yes. And let's close these facts out with a few facts about his personal life. Palahniuk is gay and came out in 2004 amid fears he'd be outed by an interviewer to whom he disclosed his sexuality in confidence, which is a cruddy way to be forced to come out. As of 2008, he lived in Washington with his partner, who is a man he met at his job with Freightliner Trucks way back right after college, and they've been together ever since.
Aww.
Aww.
I love it.
Yeah. So that's Chuck Palahniuk. Maybe he'll come up again and I'll dig more into some of the stuff he does that makes him the most Portland man ever. But for now, we have that.
I want to read Chuck Palahniuk's love story memoir. That would be interesting. Mm. Okay, great. Well, thank you for those facts. I'm glad that Guts came up again. And that is Survivor by Chuck Palahniuk. 5 stars. This is a 5-star episode.
This is a 5-star sode.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time we had one of these. I'm sure it's happened before, but I just... It's been a while.
Speaking of, it's been a while since I played a game. I wonder if anybody has a game to play.
Yes. Okay, so the game this week is name all of the tracks from Stain's album Break the Cycle.
It's been a while.
Blood and Fear. Other ones.
We had one other one that was...
Cough and Crying.
I don't know any other ones.
Heart something. Oh, are we talking about the EP or the expanded LP?
Expanded LP, please. Okay. The one I owned on CD. Anyhow, this joke has gone far enough. But they did have one other actual hit. Anywho, we'll deal with it later. Yeah, I'm going to bring it up every episode from now on. So the name of the game this week is Historical Liars.
Liar.
Liar.
Basically, I didn't want to make a game out of the subject matter of either of these books. So I took the word liar from the first one and made a game from that. It is a classic sort of buzz-in game. However, to keep Toby from being a butthead, I have some...
Aw. I feel like it's been so long since I was allowed to be a butthead. It's like...
Well, because it became a problem.
Surely your caution will wear off one of these days.
One of these days. Just one of those days. Okay.
It's all about the he said, she said.
Sorry for you guys want to get
keep
out.
It in.
Guys.
Keep it in. So the way this game is going to work is I have sort of a question. Sometimes it's phrased more like a little riddle that refers to something that is a historical misconception. An example that isn't in the questions, Tutankhamun's tomb did not have a curse written on it. That was invented by tabloid journalists to make the story more sensationalist.
Nice. Okay.
Things
good
like
example.
That.
Gotcha.
Vomiting was not part of Roman eating. They had something called a vomitorium, which referred to a hall, and people have just run with that for centuries.
I didn't know that.
If those are the easy examples, then I might be in trouble.
I think those are actually harder, and keep in mind, you will have a hint about it. Each question is worth 2 points. You can buzz in. If you get it wrong, the other person has a chance to steal for 1 point. If you choose to buzz in and you go first, that's great, but the next question, the other player gets the chance to go first to avoid... Toby.
Oh.
Is Dylan playing too or just me, Toby?
I think Dylan's gonna be too good at this.
Okay. Yeah. All right, just me and Toby. Gotcha.
Oh, you don't think Toby's gonna be too good at this?
You buzz in by saying wrong. Ready?
Yeah.
What famous French verbal blunder, often cited around the revolution, was not said despite being synonymous with that person who it's attributed
wrong.
To?
Wrong.
Wrong.
Wrong. Bailey was first.
Let them eat cake.
Oh.
That's right. Bailey is correct for 2 points there.
She actually said, let them eat brioche, which is a type of bread.
Well,
or
that is also a historical misconception.
Do they not have brioche?
Toby Seal.
Said, let them eat their panini.
I think instead of saying wrong, we should say, well, actually.
Ooh.
No. Toby, you get first cut at this one.
Okay.
First cut is the deepest.
The most famous man from the American Revolution is often said to have what odd accessory?
George Washington was supposed to have wooden teeth?
That's right, but he didn't.
Wrong.
They were made from the teeth of the enslaved people.
And animals.
Ooh.
They were real weird.
Ooh. I did not know that. Oh.
Yes, yeah. There's a whole article about that. And also, if you want to learn a little bit more about George Washington, there's a Dollop episode about his final days, which points out some other odd things about the man. This is open field now. What historical figure was actually of above average height for his time?
Wrong.
That's Toby first.
Napoleon.
That's right. Napoleon at 5'5 was pretty solid, my dudes. That's pretty solid for the time. So 2 points for Toby. So that means 4-2. Bailey, you get first cut at this one. While Carthage did get well and truly rocked by Scipio Aemilianus, he didn't do what?
Play violin.
Toby, would you like to steal for 1 point?
I believe it was burned.
No points for anyone.
Oh.
I thought it was like they played music while it burned, or maybe I'm thinking of the Titanic.
You are thinking of another Nero. Historical misconception of Nero playing the fiddle while Rome burned.
Okay.
But Scipio Aemilianus, I think later known as Scipio Africanus, was rumored to have sowed the fields of Carthage with salt so nothing may ever grow again. Maybe this is my own obsession with the Punic Wars that made me know this fact. However,
how often do you think about the Roman Empire, Andrew?
I'm on record as saying pretty much every day. And that means we are open into this final round. Bailey, you've got some catching up to do. Lots is not known about the Vikings, but one thing definitely is, they didn't have what?
Wrong.
Bailey?
Horned helmets.
That is correct, Bailey. Thank you for remembering that. You remembered our review of Children of Ashen Helm.
I do, actually. I think that's where I learned it.
Yeah, which is a great book, by the way. I still think of it fondly. So that's 2 points for Bailey. Bailey, you have gotten to 4. So Toby needs to get this one wrong for you to win. It all comes down to this. What famous woman from early American history never made the item that she's forever associated with?
Is it Betsy Ross and her flag?
That is correct, Toby.
Yes.
Stomp on home plate because you just hit a home run.
Yes. Good job, Toby. But I want to know what really happened with Betsy Ross. Like, what's her deal?
She was a figure of the revolution. Like, she was like a known person of the time. And then a picture later on showed her sewing it as like a sort of like propaganda image or like a newspaper cartoon thing. And then her like relative a century later was like, yeah, she invented it. And then people just believed him. So, yeah, that is your game. Congratulations, Toby, to your win. But I'm impressed with y'all's thing. And also, I should have made those questions a little harder.
Maybe we're just really smart.
Maybe we're just
smart. They were easy.
Wrong.
Well, actually, good game.
Good game, Andrew. Thank you. I love it. Okay. Now's the time for Dylan to tell his truth. Dylan, it's time for you to choose books at random from our shelf to read next. It's time for The Choosening.
The Choosening.
The Choosening.
Wait,
Dylan's
Bailey.
Funky Choosening.
Wait, Bailey.
Yeah.
Are you a member of the lesser sex telling me, a male, what to do?
Don't like this.
How dare you do this, especially since we live under number 116, Under the Banner of Heaven by John Krakauer.
I am so happy that this was pulled because I have been like continually going to my shelf and being like, I want to read that. I have to wait. I want to read that. I have to
wait. And you haven't watched the show.
That's exactly it. Like, I want to read it before I watch the show. I really like John Krakauer. I like Into the Wild. I like Into Thin Air. I love a good true crime. I love a good creepy religious story. I'm into it. Okay. Under the Banner of Heaven.
Well, I've read this one and I hope you like it.
To counteract Toby, I read this one and I think you'll like it.
Oh, all good. Right.
And okay. I read this one and I'm mixed.
What about Toby?
Well, Toby, it's really hard to decide what choice I should give him, considering that there are so many different options. There are billions upon billions of choices on his list.
What is he doing?
So if you zoom in and you'll notice that there's just one little speck of a choice. That it could be, it would be number 23, The Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Nice.
I thought you were doing some Muppet.
That's how you do a Carl Sagan, is you do a clogged up Kermit.
And it could sound like Carl Sagan. I thought you were doing a really bad Ira Glass.
No, my Ira Glass voice is actually pretty good.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's not bad.
Those are both pretty good. I'm excited for this one. It's Carl Sagan. I haven't read any of him before, and this is a book that's floating around there being referenced occasionally. Yeah, it'll be interesting.
And I believe he had an interesting life, so that'll be good for facts.
Yeah.
Nice.
In 2 weeks on the podcast, I will be reading Under the Banner of Heaven by John Krakauer, and Andrew's reading The Unwomanly Face of War by Svetlana Alexievich. Thanks for listening to The To Read List. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can email thetoreadlistpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Goodreads, Instagram, and the Storygraph at The To Read List Podcast.
If you are a member of a club of liars, get out of that club and join a club of truth tellers. And then once you're in that club, go to Apple Podcasts or your other podcatcher of choice and tell the truth there. You can rate us 5 stars because you know we deserve it. Write us a review, please. It helps us so much with visibility, and we love to read your reviews.
And if you have so hard to make a joke based on the subject matter of these two books.
Yep.
And if there's something that you can't tell somebody about because of a rule of a group that you're in, but you want to tell them something else, tell them about this podcast, because word of mouth is our best way of finding new listeners. It really helps. So tell your friends, tell the people who you meet in a basement, and maybe or maybe do not punch in the face, and watch our listenership grow.
Which it shouldn't.
Yeah.
Thanks to Toby and Andrew for co-hosting the podcast with me, to Dylan for sound recording, and to Miss Jillian Beth Durkee for composing our intro song. See you in 2 weeks. Happy reading.
Books.